It's time for justice. Welcome to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show, heard every Wednesday from 12:30 to 1 p.m. on 97.3 FM WRIR and at www.wrir.org. I'm your host, Marty Wegbright. This show is written and produced by Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. We give free, civil, non-criminal legal aid to low-income people in Richmond, Petersburg, Charlottesville, and surrounding cities and counties. Coming up on this week's show...
The award rate is about 50%, and the hammer comes down if they're far below or far behind that. If a judge is granting 70 to 80% of their cases, I've been told that they are... I don't know if reprimanded, but they're closely monitored to get it down to 50%. Similarly, if judges are granting 10 to 20% cases, they're also similarly scrutinized.
Disability attorney Bob Holub explains the problems of the Social Security disability system and how attorneys help claimants overcome them to get the benefits they deserve in the second part of a two-part presentation. And during this week's News You Can Use, we'll tell you about new federal rules that limit debt collections by nonprofit hospitals. All that and more coming up. Stay with us. The show is supported in part by a grant from the Virginia Law Foundation. This show, number 257, is the sole responsibility of Central Virginia Legal Aid Society and gives only general legal information. If you have a legal problem and need specific legal advice about your situation, contact an attorney. If you can't afford an attorney, we'll tell you later in the show how to get free legal advice or representation in a civil case. The Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show is heard every Wednesday at 12:30 on WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio, and online at www.wrir.org, and is made possible by community radio volunteers at WRIR. And now, this week's News You Can Use. Last month, the Obama administration adopted sweeping new rules to discourage nonprofit hospitals from using aggressive tactics to collect payments from low-income patients. Under the rules, nonprofit hospitals must now offer discounts, free care, or other financial assistance to certain needy patients. Additionally, hospitals must try to determine whether a patient is eligible for assistance before they refer a case to a debt collector, send negative information to a credit agency, place a lien on a patient's home, file a lawsuit, or seek a court order to seize a patient's earnings. The rules lay out detailed requirements for nonprofit hospitals that have or want tax-exempt status, about 60% of hospitals nationwide. Healthcare lawyers said the rules could set an industry standard, influencing the practices of for-profit hospitals because the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, or CFPB, also has endorsed them. The rules address a peculiar feature of hospital finances. For decades, uninsured patients have been required to pay much more than Medicaid, Medicare, and private insurers pay for the same services. Uninsured patients were often the only ones who paid full list prices at hospitals. Under the rules, patients eligible for financial assistance cannot be charged more than the amounts generally billed to people who have insurance through a government program or a private carrier. Each nonprofit hospital also must assess the health needs of its community at least once every 3 years and take steps to address those needs. Hospitals that do not meet this requirement may be subject to a tax penalty of $50,000. In addition, each nonprofit hospital must establish and publicize a written policy stating who is eligible for financial assistance and how people can apply. Hospitals often go to court to collect unpaid bills. Their collection practices have been documented in thousands of court decisions around the country. In many cases, the basic facts are not disputed. A patient received care. The hospitals often win by default because the patients do not show up in court. The rules generally require nonprofit hospitals to give consumers at least 120 days before taking extraordinary collection actions, which include reporting debts to credit bureaus and using debt collection agencies. The CFPB has taken a keen interest in health care debts. Since September 2013, debt collection has been the top complaint, and among all debt types, medical debt tops the list. With this week's News You Can Use, this is your host, Marty Wegbright. The Social Security disability system is bad and getting worse. Disability attorney Bob Holub explained the problems and how attorneys help claimants overcome them to get the benefits they deserve at the 2014 annual statewide Legal Aid Conference, and the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show was there. Here are his comments.
Every disability claimant is evaluated on their functional impairments based on taking the medications as prescribed. And that's critical for children cases because a lot of times the parent will say, well, he does great as long as he takes his medications. Well, he's not disabled if he takes his medications and doesn't have the problems. And the judges will ask that in the first set of questions. And that's more prevalent for kids than adults, but adults will do that too. If someone is illiterate, you're going to need to get documentation of that. But basically, if someone is literate and gone through middle school, they can still do most of the jobs they can find. Work history may provide skills transferable to other jobs if you can't perform the current job, and that's usually done by a vocational witness at your hearing. Self-employed people are looked at very suspiciously by Social Security. Regulations are very strict because they got burned in years past for people working under the table and receiving benefits. If your client comes to you and says, well, they're working for themselves or running their own business, you need to really question them rigorously on the status of the business. And, you know, a lot of times they say, well, I'm present. All I do is go in and sign the checks. Well, that's working the Social Security. If you're any decision-making position in a business, profitable or not profitable, you're working. And then if someone's on benefits, they're pretty liberal return to work rules. They definitely want people to get back to work. I'm going to briefly go through just some of the more details about the steps in the case. These are something you want to keep in mind. The initial decision, right now, they're taking 5 to 12 months to issue a decision on an application. That's up threefold from 3 years ago. The grant rate is about a quarter. You have a 60-day appeal time frame for every appeal. Reconsideration, you file an appeal of the initial denial, goes back to the same offices. 8 times out of 10, they will rubber stamp. The time for the decision is about 6 to 10 months. Award rate's about 15%. Sometimes they will send a claimant out for an examination by a Social Security physician or psychologist. If denied at this point, you request a hearing. And this is really where, in my practice and most disability cases, this is where your chances are the best because it's really the only time you're face-to-face with a decision maker, you're dealing with a judge, you're able to have a hearing and not just send documents into a black hole. The wait time for a hearing was requested is about a year to a year and a half, maybe a little less. It varies. Each office has a different backlog. The award rate is about 50%, and the hammer comes down if they're far below or far behind that. If a judge is granting 70 to 80% of their cases, I've been told that they are, I don't know if reprimanded, but they're closely monitored to get it down to 50%. Similarly, if judges are granting 10 to 20% cases, they're also similarly scrutinized. These are required steps. So you have to go through the process administratively up the ladder. It'd be great if you could avoid the... And they've tried that a few years ago in New England, then they stopped. They tried an experimental procedure where you get initial denial and you go right to the law judge hearing, which seems to make sense to me, but they stopped it for some reason. Obesity can be a factor in determination. There is a Social Security ruling on that. The judge will take obesity and weight into consideration. But, you know, again, it comes down to the judge is going to make credibility determinations. If the client has been told numerous times to lose weight or diabetes, a lot of times when people have bad knees, and if they're, you know, if they're obese and they can't get a knee replacement, and if they refuse to do anything about weight loss, then that might cut against you in terms of a credibility determination. The other thing is, a lot of times that folks who've done this will have a person that says, well, I can't work, I have COPD. The next question out of your mouth is, how much are you smoking? Well, I'm trying to cut back. I'm down to a pack a day. It's a losing case, because every doctor in the world would tell that person to stop smoking. And the smoking is material to the health problem that they're alleging disability for. So they will be factored in. The appeals council step, where you can appeal a law judge decision, the denial rate's about 75% or higher. Remand rate's about 20%. They rarely award cases. It takes about 6 to 20 months for them to get a decision. At that point, you can appeal to federal court. It's a civil complaint. Medical additional records are usually not allowed. Social Security will have a general counsel. It's about 10 to 12 months. A brief's an oral argument only. Denial rate's about 75%. So as you can see, just from those statistics, the law judge hearing is really your best chance of success on these claims. Most of the federal judges will just want to wash their hands of these things, and if they do see a reason for reversal, they will remand the case. Very rarely will the federal judge award benefits. They just don't want to get involved in making that decision. These are some things that we've run across in our practice. That you know, when a client comes to you with a disability claim, first of all, how to orient yourself to the claim and kind of look into the crystal ball here and be a mind reader on a lot of these issues, not only to get the relevant facts, but also what this case is going to be about for the client. And these are some things to really think about. You want to make sure that they're going to get something out of the case if you win it. I mean, if they have an SSI case is a type of disability that's affected by household income. And so if a person comes to you with an SSI claim and their husband is, a CEO of a Fortune 500 company, they're going to be financially ineligible for benefits, and you don't want to waste your time because it'll never pay them a dime. There are other issues, such as if they're liens, they haven't worked enough. They look at work history 10 years prior to application to see if they've qualified for disability insurance benefits or DIB. Those date last insured is when they were last covered, which will be in a denial letter should you'd be fortunate enough for them to have it. SSI benefits come with Medicaid coverage. Disability benefits come with Medicare coverage 2 years from their first month of eligibility. And that's really, quite valuable to people with chronic health problems. And typical things, which I'm sure all of you have run across, is if there are any significant personality conflicts. Clients with personality disorders usually have to be handled very particularly. They have unrealistic expectations. I'm sure I want to fight this all the way to the Supreme Court. If they're going to be incarcerated or likely to be incarcerated, you're not eligible for benefits. So if they're going to say, well, I caught a charge, I'm going to jail for 5 years, you want to wait on that file when you get out, because there's no reason to do it. This is the rude surprise when you win the case and your client calls you hysterical because there's $5,000 of their back benefits missing. If someone gets disability insurance benefits or DIB, those are subject, any government owed money, IRS, state, child support gets a VIP pass to take those benefits away. And that's not for SSI benefits, but only for disability insurance. So if child support enforcement has an arrearage of child support for your client, they will go after it. And Social Security just does what child support tells them. There's nothing really that you can do other than have your client try to, negotiate something with child support enforcement. But that can be an awfully rude awakening. Again, the other thing, I've had many clients say, well, I owe $20,000 to the IRS. They're going to take the money. If they've taken every tax return for this person, then they're certainly going to take other federal benefits to which they're entitled. And so those are things you want to try to suss out and maybe figure out at the initial conversation or first few conversations so that they're not, you know, in this for 2 years and get zero at the end of it.
You've been listening to disability attorney Bob Holub explaining the problems of the Social Security disability system and how attorneys help claimants overcome them to get the benefits they deserve at the 2014 annual statewide Legal Aid Conference of Virginia Legal Aid Attorneys. We'll be back in a moment. We continue now with the remarks of disability attorney Bob Holub at the 2014 annual statewide Legal Aid Conference, explaining the problems of the Social Security disability system and how attorneys help claimants overcome them to get the benefits they deserve.
And you also talk to your client initially. You want to really try to get at what's their concept of what their own functional limitations are. And by and large, and I don't know where this came from, if it's just part of the Jungian collective unconscious, but I can't tell you how many people of all ages, all races, all educational backgrounds, why can't you work? Well, I can't sit too long. I can't stand too long. You hear that over and over again. And I tell them, well, okay, but that's losing testimony for your disability case because that is way too vague. Or, you know, it's been a while or it's been a good long while. Though you have to try to get people into specifics as much as possible. What I try to do is if someone, especially for mental health impairments, is try to focus on a bad day. What are you unable to do? ADLs or activities of daily living. What can you not do for yourself or others or able to handle on a bad day? And that's a good tactic for really drawing out what the worst problems with the worst functional limitations are. And this is something, again, what is work, working for cash, self-employment, unemployment benefits. If someone's getting unemployment, real briefly, that's a state benefit where they're looking for work and swearing under oath that they're able to work. And if you're getting that, you're not going to get Social Security disability at the same time. And then this other concept, which I think is important to get across to the client initially, is, well, I can't work, I can't do what I used to do. Well, that only gets you to step four. That doesn't get you to step five. Often we get folks who maybe used to be a CNA for 20 years, or maybe used to, one we get a lot is people who drive trucks. That does not prove your case. And these are some things we talked about before. SSDI, disability insurance benefits, it's based on a work history, where SSI is based on household income and resources. These are some things that you need to investigate and maybe get some more out of them. I can't sit too long, stand too long. This one's also very important. I'm in pain all over, all day, every day, 24/7. That's losing testimony. I can't lift heavy things. I don't like to be around crowds. I can't walk long distances. I'm depressed. I have panic attacks. That is insufficient for any disability case as a functional limitation. And one thing, again, with sort of trying to orient your client to the regulatory definition of disability and what you're going to have to prove, you know, just not finding work or losing work, it's immaterial. In fact, if you tell the judge, if the client tells the judge, well, I stopped working because I got laid off, there's nothing medical in that sentence. So there's nothing you can really hang your case on if that's the case. And again, this is something I just mentioned earlier, you want to stay in the present. What's your current treatment? What's your current living situation? Again, the functional limitations and the kind of work you're going to be fighting over whether your client can do is an easy-to-learn, low-stress, sit-down job for 40 hours a week. And that's how I usually define it to a client, because that is broken down that almost anyone can understand. And the key is medical records. Unfortunately, or fortunately, a lot of socioeconomic factors can be important to judges. Drug and alcohol abuse is at the top of the list. And it's a shame that I have to point these out, but they are important. If there are multiple persons receiving disability benefits in the household, there's an extensive criminal record. If your client's pregnant, if they have a licensure that they've kept current, if they're keeping their CDL, they have to take a physical exam. And I lost a case a few years ago because my client didn't tell me that he went and got his CDL physical 2 months before his hearing. Of course, we got it, and he said it was a back pain case. And this guy said there's nothing wrong with his back. They recertified him for CDL, case over. If a client is attending school, unless they're failing out, the judges are going to look at that as having ability to work. If they're traveling to community college to take classes or getting A's and B's, even part-time, if a client's trying to get a GED, well, if you can be successful in school, you can certainly be successful at a sedentary full-time job to the judges. It's just going to make it very difficult to prove the case. Some positives, if there's a good work history, if the person worked for 10 years and, boom, they stopped working for medical problems, even the hardest of judges will acknowledge that. If they're in a stable marriage or relationship, that's also looked at as a positive thing. Church or religious faith, veterans. Many judges are veterans, and that can be a positive factor to bring out, too. When you're taking a child case, the parents just think this child is just knocking at death's door. And you really need to get the medical and school records to see what's wrong with the kid and what the functional limitations are. Again, if you get the school records and the kid is at multiple IEPs or getting individualized instruction, they're failing classes, there's severe behavioral problems, then that's an indicator of the functional problems from the medical records. You really want to go right to those and get, because that's what's going to matter in the case. And again, something I mentioned before, the younger the client, the more medical evidence you'll need. If there's some diagnoses, fibromyalgia, chronic fatigue syndrome, seizures, which may or may not be epileptic seizures, headaches, or things of that nature, and there's a ruling that I included on fibromyalgia, these are very sort of disfavored or suspect medical problems. Or if you just don't know, if the medical records are going to show what they need to show, maybe ask the doctor. If they have a doctor that's treating them, they said they should file for disability, we'll see if the doctor will put the pen to paper and write your client out of work. If you get that from the outset, at least you know you got something to start out with. But if all their doctors say they can go back to work, then you know that they really are going to have some trouble. There really is no easy answer for failure to get or inability to get medical treatment. For those of you who have not done a disability case, I wanted just to give you some ideas about what you're facing at a hearing. It's not an adversarial proceeding. It's an administrative hearing that's labeled as informative. You still have the burden of proof of proving your case. And like I said before, this is really the only time that you're face-to-face, although face-to-face meaning a lot of times where people will be on a video teleconference to the judge. I always prefer the clients be face-to-face so that the judge can see them, hear them, and look at them. Because if your client is really in pain or really having problems, that does not translate well on a video teleconference. Hearings are usually 30 to 60 minutes. 90% of them will just have one other witness, and that'll be a vocational expert witness, which will talk about jobs at steps 4 and 5 of the sequential evaluation process. And rarely there'll be a medical expert there, which you really don't want. And you really have to have the case together to fit your client's testimony, your theory of the case, and argument within this time frame. Judges usually have 5 to 6 of these hearings a day. They are really intolerant of going over. It delays their whole day. And it puts you in the good light. If you get in there, you have all your stuff in there, your client's prepared, you're prepared, you can get this done within 30 minutes, and you consistently do that, then you're one of the good guys. You're not one of the guys that or gals that delays the judge's day unnecessarily, and that is noticed. Your client's sworn, but you don't have to worry about civil procedure or evidence. They talk informally. Records are all electronic now. All the administrative and medical records are in the document. The vocational witness will testify after your client about hypothetical questions from the ALJ and you on different work restrictions and available jobs based on the work restrictions. One thing you need to have down and have evidence for is the date of the disability onset. That's when did this person meet the requirements for disability. Most of the time, it is not when they stop working. I recommend that you hang the disability onset on something in the medical records. MRI in December of 2012 showing 5 herniated discs. Treatment from orthopedist, patient has failed conservative treatment for whatever. Hospitalization for manic episode of bipolar disorder, GAF of 45.
You've been listening to disability attorney Bob Holub explaining the problems of the Social Security disability system and how attorneys help claimants overcome them to get the benefits they deserve at the 2014 annual statewide Legal Aid Conference of Virginia Legal Aid Attorneys in the second part of a two-part presentation. This is the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. That's all for this week's Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. This show is heard every Wednesday from 12:30 to 1 p.m. The show is the sole responsibility of Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. To see if you can get free civil legal aid, call during intake hours. These are Monday through Thursday, 9 a.m. to 11:30 a.m. and 1 p.m. to 2:30 p.m. The phone number is 200-6046 for intake, 648-1012 for the main number, and 1-800-868-1012 to call toll-free. This show provides only general legal information. If you have a legal problem and need specific legal advice about your situation, contact an attorney. If you can't afford one, call Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. Friday, January 30th, 2015 is the 7th annual Earned Income Tax Credit, or EITC, Awareness Day. Join us next Wednesday at 12:30 p.m. when Nancy Porcari, attorney at the Community Tax Law Project, explains the EITC that helps low-income workers keep more of their income through credits, resulting in a larger income tax refund. That's law for the rest of us next week on the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. I'm Marty Wegebrink.